enjoy Marcus dancing to that particular tune. You're listening to the Albion Roar here in association with Old Football Shirts on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on our podcast, on Audio Boom. My name is Alan Wares. The Albion came back from 2-0 down last week to draw 2-2 against Fulham in a match that was probably there for the taking. And in a phrase not heard since the heady days of Sussex dominating domestic cricket, Murray is inching ever closer to his ton after his brace last week brought his Albion haul to 97. This week, the Albion's women's season in the top flight, the Women's Super League, starts with a home match 25 miles away in Crawley against Bristol City. Later in the show, we'll hear from Albion manager Hope Powell and midfielder Chloe Peplow. Also this week, in the first of an occasional series, I'll be talking to a new Brighton fan from overseas and find out what it is that made them start following the Super Seagulls. This week, it's a football fan from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Joining me this week to talk about the Fulham game and probably to go a little bit misty-eyed over Glenn Murray is Raw band member Marcus Hancocks. Marcus, how are you, mate?
Yes, not too bad, actually. Yeah, I was out for a friend's birthday last night, so a little bit jaded.
A little bit jaded.
Fair to say.
Did you go to Ultimate Power or something?
Yes, I did indeed go to Ultimate Power. I wasn't going to. I was going to get up early for a park run and all sorts of things, but unfortunately,
nature took over.
Yeah.
Okay, small matter, but,
the alcohol took over.
Oh, dear, never mind. Right, should we talk about football, because this is the Albion Raw?
Yes, absolutely.
We'll give it a go. Okay, so the Fulham game last week. The team news was slightly surprisingly that Lewis Dunk was brought back in favour of Leon Balogun. Apart from that, it was largely the first team that we've come to expect. Martin Montoya retains his place ahead of just about every other right back that we've got at the club. Before we start talking about the specifics, Marcus, give us your overview of the game.
It's one of those games where you think, you know what, that's where you would expect, and I hate to say it, you expect three points.
You expect teams like Fulham.
Yeah, absolutely. Because those are the teams that are in and around us. Those are the teams that are going to be at the bottom end of the division, making no bones about it. It's going to be Fulham, Cardiff, us, Huddersfield, Bournemouth.
The burning smell?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was trying not to mention that lot.
Any euphemisms you can come up with
Wilfred Zaha FC. It's one of those, but of course, as the game went on, and when you're 2-0 down, and then you get, so personally, I think it was 2 points dropped, but glad to
after
get
after an
point.
Hour, you probably as a different after, perspective,
exactly,
isn't it?
And that's the whole point. Before the game, you think, right, we're going to get 3 points here. When you're 2-0 down, you're absolutely delighted at getting a point. You know, when it looked like nothing was going to happen.
So. Absolutely. Now, for the most part, I think it was probably fair to say that the first half wasn't really that much of a spectacle. I mean, we can talk about it afterwards when we talked about this, because this is the great thing about the West Stand Upper, certainly, and probably a lot of people do it at the Amex, is you must have your post-mortem. You've got to get it out of your system before you go home and kick the dog. Yeah. Is a lot of people were saying that, you know, the first half a bit boring, second half quite exciting for a neutral, absolutely sort of heart-wrenching for us. But the main talking point of the first half... Go on, you go first.
The main talking point being the penalty being Pascal Gross, I take it.
In the first instance, and we always have to ask this, even though we know the answer, was it a penalty?
From where I was, I think it was. But we all know, and we'll talk about him later, but we all know that Glenn is very good at the phrase winning penalties, shall we say.
Very
diplomatic. I do think he had his legs taken from him, so I don't doubt it was a penalty in this instance. A few times I've seen penalties and you sort of go, whoo-hoo, like, you know, you think, oh, you know, lucky to get that.
We've won that rather than had it awarded.
Absolutely. So for me, it was a definite penalty, without a doubt. And then, of course, Pascal stood up to take it.
Now, this is one thing, I think it probably does go back about 10 years and to the days of, well, probably Glenn in the earlier days, but also talking about just about everyone at the Albion from Gus onwards just couldn't take a penalty. And I think that nervousness has stayed with us. So when Gross stepped up, how confident did you feel?
I for some reason I didn't feel confident at all. It's funny because he has scored the two previous penalties that he's taken, but they've been If you're a goalkeeper and you've watched him take those penalties, you've probably got a good chance of saving them if you go the right way. And I don't mean
distance,
because they're kind of, you know, they're on target, you know, to be fair. Did Gross miss a penalty? No, probably the keeper saved it, because to me, a missed penalty is when Leo Ajoa's still in orbit at the moment and Glenn Murray's against whoever it was last, Leicester or whoever it was last year. You know, if you go the right way, you're going to save Pascal Gross's penalties, basically. Yes. Unlike these Shearers and put them in a top corner and you just can't get anywhere near them. So
absolutely. But I mean, I think the point that we were making after the game certainly is that, I mean, Gross has now taken three penalties for us. The first two have gone in. But in each and every case, the keeper has got something on it.
Yeah,
and the nature of a penalty is that you should give the keeper not even a sniff. Even if he goes the right way, don't give him a sniff.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly.
And you know, the first one, for those who are wondering, the first one was against Spurs at the back end of last season. It went in, fine. The Manchester United one, obviously, which was, you know, I think De Gea would be kicking himself for that, because that was a massive, you know, deflection into the roof of the net. And again, poorly taken, you know, along the ground, down the middle.
Yeah.
And even the fact that the keeper dived, I think the fact that the keeper dived allowed it to go in, but it was largely along the floor.
Yeah.
And so this one, it was hit into the corner, or pretty much into the corner, but it was just hitting so softly, wasn't
it? Yes, I think that was okay. I think if it had more pace on it, it probably would have gone in and the keeper might have got a hand to it and the momentum would have carried it into the net, a bit like his previous other two penalties. I mean, the only person I've ever seen who's been able to sort of slot it along the ground in that manner and sort of almost get it within, you know,
get away with it.
Playing card width of the post is Eric Cantona. He's about the only person I've ever seen do that. So even if the guy keeper dives full stretch, he still manages to get it between the post and the keeper's hand. But it was strange. It just seemed that you're right. The whole stadium just thought, you know, it's going to be saved or he's going to miss it or whatever. This isn't going
it
in.
Didn't, it, no it one just, felt confident.
No, and I don't know why. Bearing in mind he'd already scored against Man United, but
absolutely,
just the way he looked. And then and I believe it then came out in the Argus afterwards that actually I think he had his foot strapped before he took there was something in the Argus about the fact that Pascal Gross had his foot strapped in the first half before the penalty was taken, when there was some it just all seemed a bit odd,
a bit meh. Okay, so I'll say that was the main talking point. I think probably the other big talking point was Fulham's goal. Now, there was four goals in total, and I think that was probably the only decent one of the game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, actually. It was. At first I thought it was offside, but it wasn't.
It was just
brilliant off the ball movement, and it was a great little sort of lofted pass which caught, you know, Duncan Duffy out, which, you know, the one concern about them is they can be a little bit statuesque at times, but that's, it was decent, you know, but then you just got to give the credit sometimes, as Andy would say if he was here, sometimes you just got to give the credit for a good goal.
I think it was a good goal. Well crafted.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and you just got to say hats off to you. That was, but up until that point, Fulham hadn't really offered much and we did most of the huffing and puffing.
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Lewis Dunk there. There seemed to be, there was a school of thought that maybe considered, did he come back a game too soon? I thought that personally he was beasted a little bit by Mitrovic, and Lewis Dunk has kept better centre forwards quieter and in his pocket than before. So, you know, if you were to sit and ask Chris or ask Lewis, you know, did he come back a game too soon? They'd, you know, possibly be a little bit indignant and say, no, you know, he was perfectly fine, but, you know, let's have the fans' perspective. You know,
we all know, I think, you know, it's been on record, Chris has said many a time that, you know, they won't play unless they're 100% fit and the medical team have assessed them as being fit. But it was a bit like David Stockdale at Reading a couple of years ago, in the season that we didn't go up eventually, where he was quite clearly unfit. And I think he came back for the Reading game and actually made two howlers. Now, David Stockdale's a great keeper, and this is not a reflection on David Stockdale at all. Got a lot of time for the guy. But quite clearly, I think we drew that game 2-2, and I think it was a couple of sort of calamities that stopped out. Unusually, at that point, he'd ironed out all the errors under the Hoopier era and stuff. And he was clearly unfit. And again, I think hand on heart, Chris will probably look at it and go, yeah, probably I did bring Lewis back a game too early. I'm surprised he came back before the international break. I thought he would have had that game off, this week off, and then perhaps, You know, because Balogun really, in the half he played against United and against Liverpool, I don't think he put a foot wrong. So I think he probably could be a little bit annoyed, actually, Balogun, that he's lost his place.
So Chris has his first 11, absolutely, and he'll pick it. But I think that, you know, certainly from the fans' perspective, a lot of people didn't think that Balogun had put a foot wrong, really. I mean, and he looked quite decent, and, you know, like the international he is. So, yeah, I mean, and I think possibly also bear in mind that because we've now seen Balogun play, you know, we're confident of a decent sort of backup player.
Yeah, absolutely. He will, you know, and everybody was a bit worried about Connor Goldson when he left, but obviously we've got, you know, Balogun who can step straight in. It is a long season. Yeah. They are going to get suspended, sent off, whatever, because that's the nature of being a centre half.
Yes.
So Balogun will get his chance, but I think, you know, again, I think he might be a little bit miffed, shall we say, that after, you know, keep the shirt, you play well, keep the shirt policy, which Chris is obviously an advocate of, and then Dunk comes back and quite clearly it looked like he wasn't fit.
It was only at 90%, and in the Premier League, you can't really afford that.
Exactly. So yeah. I think, you know, so Chris perhaps dropped a wicket there. But then he would have said to Dunk, are you fit to play? Because at the end of the day, even if the medical team say, well, he can kick a football and he can head a football and he won't, you know, he's not going to do himself a mischief if he plays today. So he probably would have said to Dunk, are you fit? And Dunk said, yes, I am, boss. And it's kind of like, right, okay.
Right.
Whereas really, maybe Dunk should have said, actually, boss, you know what? But then they don't want to lose their place in the team.
Yeah,
because I can understand
why. At the end of the day, it was Dunk's slip that allowed Mitrovic in, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Now, whether that was an injury or just Dunk, because we've seen him do that a million times before, so I'm not going to beast necessarily.
Oh, he's still in credit, but, you know, and the fact that the you know, Glenn Murray bailed him out sort of twice to, you know.
Exactly.
Talking of Glenn Murray, now then, I know that actually you're quite keen on him as a player, but this hasn't always been the case. Now, once upon a time, he used to play for the Burning Smell up the road.
He did.
And you were quite cross with him. So was there a particular specific moment that made you think that actually Glenn is my hero after all, rather than, you know, the turncoat that you felt he was once?
I haven't carried it like some people have and still do.
Well,
it's
some in your cabal did, yeah.
One person in particular did, and the words were forgiven but not forgotten. Personally, yeah, of course I was annoyed at the time, but then when the facts came out of Glenn Murray's departure, obviously being the free agent that he was, and a certain ex-manager didn't rate him or want to give him the money that he wanted, even though apparently Tony Bloom said, you know, if you want to pay him that, we can pay him that, etc., etc., etc. What for me did it was when he was playing for Palace and he scored in those first two goals at the Amex, and he didn't celebrate, and he could have done, and he didn't. And, you know, you think, well, hats off to you, mate. You know, you scored two goals at place where, and obviously the manager who didn't rate you, and you haven't rubbed the face and you haven't ran the length of the pitch and, you know,
done a sliding knee drop,
which a lot of players do, and the fact that he didn't do that, and then of course he turns up on loan for Reading and scores against us again.
Just to rub it in, yes, Gus, yeah. You made a mistake.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. All of that. Personally, at first I was annoyed, but then you would be annoyed when a player signs for your rivals. You're going to be, but.
Would you care to speculate when he's going to get his ton?
Well, I certainly in our sort of predictions at the beginning of the season, I said he'd probably be our top scorer. So I would think he's probably going to get his ton easily before Christmas. Probably within the next month. What, three, isn't it, he needs?
Three
more to get his ton. I think he's got three goals in him before December, definitely. Well, before Christmas.
And what will you do?
Assuming it's at the
Amex.
Oh, blimey. Well, if it's at the Amex, I probably will try and seek him after the game and have numerous selfies with him. But I try and avoid that sort of thing that I know some people do, where they see a player and, you know, selfie every 5 minutes. I don't generally do that sort of thing. But, I hope it comes. As I say, I think he's our only proven Premier League striker. He's proving again, you know.
I think also he's in the form of his life at the moment,
he is in the form. Yes, he's in the form of his life. He's looking leaner and fitter than he did when he played for us with Dean, but maybe that's just an age thing and he's looking after himself better, like Bruno is, etc. But there's no reason why he can't play for another couple of seasons, because he obviously looks after himself. Glenn Murray has never based his game on pace. It's not as if he's a pacey striker, because he's never had it. Exactly, he doesn't have any, but you know, if you want an edit and a fox in a box, you know, and even he said only recently, you know, he doesn't train as hard as the others do, a bit like our friends, you know, Simon Morgan and other players who are sort of in the twilight of their career, you know, they don't need to run around on the training pitch because that's not what he does. His game's never been that.
Absolutely. So a statue for when he's done?
I definitely think he should be mentioned in, when he's done, he definitely should be mentioned in the same breath as Ward and
Well, he's beaten them for a record, hasn't he?
As far as goals concerned, yeah, but some people still, you know, Ward for
Ward was a bit more magic, wasn't he?
It
was a bit, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And people of a certain age, you know, will get all misty-eyed about Peter Ward. But he is a, and then obviously, you know, then there's years and years of waiting, then Bobby Zamora comes along, and then obviously, you know, and now Glenn Murray has come along, so he's sort of like the Bobby Zamora and the Peter Ward of the... sort of the I want to say the Amex generation, but he was here before.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. No, and the less said about Solly March's miss, the better. You're going to mention it now.
Well, you're right. The less said about it, the better. Blimey. Again, it's one of these things where if you're going to do it, at least hit the target. The fact that it didn't even.
That was going to join a zero-as penalty, wasn't it?
It was, exactly.
Talking of penalties, since since the With Dean era, do you know that of all players who's taken five or more penalties for the club, only one player has a 100% record?
One player has 100%?
Yeah.
Or is that not someone who's scored one take and that's
no,
it?
No, just of those who've taken at least five. Any ideas?
No.
Spanish Dave,
of course. Oh, yeah, it would be, yeah.
Never missed a penalty, scored all five of them.
Wow.
And yes, I was right, folks. Marcus has gone misty-eyed over Glenn Murray. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. My name's Alan Wares. I'm here with Marcus Hancocks, and we're talking all things Albion. Now, this week marks the start of the women's football season. We have our home games, sadly, all the way up in Crawley. Hopefully that will change soon. We can have something back here as soon as possible. It'll be fabulous to have the women's team playing around here. But earlier this week... I caught up with the Albion manager, Hope Powell. In a few minutes, you'll get to hear from Albion midfielder, Chloe Peplow. But first, let's hear what Albion manager Hope Powell had to say ahead of the new season.
Is this team ready? I think we're as ready as we can be. It's been a really, really good pre-season. The girls have worked, in my opinion, exceptionally hard. It is a step up from where they were, so... It's going to be a challenge, we know that, but we're obviously going to be, you know, ready and give it our best shot. I think we'll know whether we're really ready for WSL1 when we've certainly got the first game underway and you know, the game's coming up after that. It's a bit, we know it's a big challenge.
Six new signings this summer. Just tell us, who are the key players that to look out for? Who do you think is really going to shine on the pitch this season?
To be honest, I can't really single out any one individual. I think because the league is quite new to most of the players, some of them have had the experience of WSL1. I think with the new signings, certainly Victoria Williams, centre-half, really gives us something a little bit extra in defence, firms it up somewhat. Again, Emily Simpkin, unfortunately, sustained an injury last week, so she'll be out tomorrow. We've also signed Jodie Brett, she's experienced WSL1 before, so that's good. I think Kaylee Green, experienced WSL1 player, Welsh international. So we've kind of had to target key positions where we felt we were a little bit light. It's going to be a long season. Last season, we sustained quite a few injuries. We've already sustained injuries. So I think it's going to take the whole squad to really, you know, the ambition is to stay in WSL1. So it will take the whole squad to keep us there, I think. So I wouldn't really like to single out any one person at this stage. If I come back in 6 months, I might be able to tell you something different. Am I confident of a win? I'm confident that we'll do our level best to get the win. I think football, you know, is so unpredictable. Their desire to win is as much as our desire to win. So it's a game we recognise that we've got a chance of winning. So we have to be at our very, very best in order to make sure we try and get those points on the board. Are we guaranteed a win? Absolutely not. You know, we have to work for it, and we will have to work for every game in this league.
Can I ask you about the restructuring of the Women's Super League this season? A lot has changed, hasn't it? In your opinion, is this a step forward for women's football. There has been some criticism from some clubs that they can't meet the criteria of being in that top tier. What are your thoughts about the revamped?
Yeah, it's a challenge. You know, fortunately, I'm at a club that can meet the criteria. So I think from Brighton's point of view, it gives us a real opportunity to grow the club, to grow the community alliances that we have, to grow the development squad and grow the interest in women's football in this part of the country. So for us, it's a good thing. It gives us an opportunity to be in the top flight, which we're relishing at this moment. Up until this point, at least, anyway. In terms of the game moving forward, I think it's in a really healthy position at the moment. I think the league, it does have its challenges. It's, you know, I almost kind of look at it as three leagues within a league. You know, you've got the top teams that have, you know, more resources, and you've got the middle bracket, then you've got the lower bracket. But I think it's a work in progress, and I think that progress is getting better and better, to be honest.
And from the Albion's point of view, it's great to see the men's side in the top tier and the women's side
absolutely.
Top tier. Do you think that means better integration for men and women in this club and other clubs too, for that matter?
Again, I can only speak about Brighton. I think since I've been here, which hasn't even been a year yet, I think I've been here 8-9 months now. It certainly is a community club. It felt like a community club when I came to visit. It is integrated. As you can see, the women's, we're embedded within the club. We're at this facility. We're training at the University of Sussex, where the men used to train, simply because the training ground, they've got to make some alterations to fit everybody in. But I think in terms of that integration, I think it's exceptional. I would argue that it's probably one of the best in the country, to be honest.
And how are you feeling about playing at Crawley this season in the league?
Yeah, it's great. It's great. We played a pre-season friendly there, which was good. Facilities are really good. They've worked really hard on the pitch. So it's a good surface. It meets the criteria, which is important. And I'm really hoping that the fans will come out and support the girls, because we really appreciate that support.
And just finally, are we seeing enough female managers like yourself with your sort of experience in women's football at present, would you say?
My honest answer, no. It would be great to have more females at the forefront, the lead roles. It is about opportunity and making sure that they have the right qualifications, the right experience to be in those positions. So I would like to see more, and hopefully in time that will change.
Thank you.
Is this what you came for, Hope, what you signed up for?
What do you mean?
Into the elite?
Well, I know the ambitions of the club. I know Paul Barber very well. They were ambitious when I met with them. The owner is quite ambitious. He wants both male and female teams in the top tier. I am a bit of a builder. I like to build things. So it was a great starting point for me. This is what it's all about, I guess. I think the transition going from part-time to full-time, it does take a little bit of time. I think they were balancing sort of working, coming to training, work training in the evening, going home, you know, getting up for work, coming to, you know, that's really tough. And I have to give a lot of credits to the girls for doing that. I think we've reached a point now, sort of, I don't know how many weeks in, 8, 9, 10 weeks in now, that... you know, they're starting to appreciate the full-time program. They're more relaxed with it. They know what the expectations are. I think everybody found the pre-season really, really tough, not being familiar with training every day to that intensity. They've managed to get through that, and again, they're pushing themselves on. So I have to give them, you know, I take my hat off to them, you know, respect, because they've done and worked really, really hard. I think the opportunity to be a professional footballer is, you know, if you love football, is every player's dream, and they've been given the chance, and they're going to give it a good go, which is great. Success for me, stay in the division.
Thank you.
And along the way, we set the goals. You know, you target the teams that hopefully you can, you got a realistic chance of competing with. We know some teams are further ahead than we are. We accept that. We don't like it. Doesn't mean to say that we're not going to give it a good go. But from my perspective, it is about staying in WSL One.
I'm joined by Albion player Chloe Peplow. Chloe, welcome to the Raw.
Thank you.
Let's just start off by saying, how did you first come to join Brighton & Hove Albion?
So it was January of this year, just gone, and I'd been at Birmingham previously, so I've been at Birmingham for around 14 years, so I've been at Birmingham since I was a child, progressed through into the first team, and then I'd signed a contract, and I was coming towards the end of my contract, and I was looking for a move, just like a bit of a change, because I was so used to being at home, and I wasn't really playing, so I was looking around, and I knew Kirsty Hullen previously from Birmingham, so I was looking for a move, looking around, and I knew of Kirsty, I knew of some of the girls here and of the setup and how Albion were looking to go, and really it was a two-way communication, and once I came down and have a look, there was no going back, like it was where I wanted to sign.
Had you felt you got as far as you could go at Birmingham City then?
It got to a point, yeah, where I'd broke through the first couple of seasons I was playing, like I was getting game time week in, week out, and there was a change of management, and it's always a change of opinion, and I thought it was vital for me that I needed to move somewhere that would push me on, because I got comfortable, like I'd been there for so long, I was comfortable with the environment, with the players, and I just felt like I needed a new move, a new step, something to push me at this age to progress me on in my career.
So when you first had a look around the Albion, I mean, you probably looked at a lot of other places. When you first had a look around here, what were your first impressions?
I thought the facilities were amazing. At the previous clubs I've been at, obviously at Birmingham and other clubs, it's very different. So the facilities were outstanding. But not even just that, Hope was very welcoming, and Amy, and I like how integrated it is with the men's side. Like, never have been.
Wait, give us an example of that.
So, the training ground. So we're allowed to use the men's facilities. Obviously, being based here at the Amex, like at previous clubs, it's never been like that. It's always been men and women, so it's always been separated. And that was a big factor for me in coming here, because it's good to see that like both men and women, like they're treated equally.
Okay, so tell us about you on the pitch. Whereabouts are you playing, and what's your style of play? What's Hope asked you to do?
So I'm a central midfielder, either defensively or so 4-8 in the terms of football, and I think I'm just a player that likes to get on the ball, play the ball, nothing fancy, just simple, like trying to control the game, get on the ball, give it, get on the ball, give it, nice and simple.
Brutal or a ballerina?
Brutal, I'd say, not a ballerina, I wouldn't like to say ballerina.
Okay, so when you're playing, you're often alongside Daniel Bewitt, yes?
Yeah, no, often alongside Danny, yeah.
Tell us how you get on with her on the pitch.
I get on really well with Danny. When I moved originally, I was in a house with Danny, so I got moved into a house. Obviously, I've known of Danny before, previously playing Notts and her being with England before, but Danny for me has been great because she's experienced. I think she's a player that I'd like to turn into, so I've been able to take a lot of her and learn off her. She's always helped, like, good at communicating, and she took me under her wing really because I've asked her questions and she's helped me out, but she's someone that I want to be like, so it's been great to, I love, obviously live with her, but alongside her, playing alongside her as well, has really brought me on and developed me as well.
Okay, so are you two of a similar style? Because we've had Danielle on the Raw, and she was saying, you know, that she's, again, a get-the-ball-down person, likes to sort of dictate the terms and what have you. I suppose the men's equivalent here would be someone like probably Pascal Gross, but maybe slightly more withdrawn. So are you kind of a similar player, or are you a good counterfoil? I mean, you're the one that wins it and then gives it to Danny, or how does it work?
I'd say we're pretty similar. I'd say, like, we're kind of the same stuff, and we get it and we give it, but Danny is very aggressive.
Yeah.
So she's a player that's in there a lot more, and I think I'd be the one that would get it and give it to Danny, and then, but she's always like, she's like, if I was describing her, she's like a little ball terrier. Like, she's just always in and about, and she's got that more so to her game than I have. So I'd get it and give it to Danny. But we do have differences, but I'd say like our style of play in possession is pretty similar.
You're a little bit taller than Danny.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So you can sort of win the odd aerial battle.
Yeah, the odd one. But she's still up there and she still wins them as well, so.
Okay, so tell us about the team that ultimately got promotion, that finished third in the second tier of women's football. Tell us about that team that you joined last season.
So first of all, to join into a team, like on a personal fact, the girls were lovely. So the girls were really, they helped me integrate, and they're very good. But it's also a very talented team. Like, there's so many different players, and they've all got their individual talents, but I say personally on the level, more than anything else, I've noticed that they're just nice individuals.
Right.
And that really helps, I think, coming into a new team. But it's a team that's got a lot of not necessarily a lot of experience, but a lot to give. And a lot more to show this season.
Well, so you say they're nice. I mean, I've seen them play. Seen you guys play several times at Lancing, and nice is not a word I'd actually sort of tend to use for that team. There's a few terriers in there, isn't there?
No, there definitely is. I'd say off the pitch, they're all lovely.
Oh, I see.
Like, but as soon as we hit the pitch, obviously it's a different ball game. There's definitely a few. They like to shove a challenge in there and get
give us
there
a for instance. Come on, name names.
Definitely Danny Buett, and she got Ini Umatong as well. She's one of the worst in training, like using her arms, like to get her to the face and everything. But
In training.
But she likes to train as she plays. But no, Danny and Ini, but Ini more so causes them like unintentionally. Like Ini will just be the odd flick of the arm, like she can't control her limbs. But Danny likes to play how she plays, and she's always been a very like aggressive player. So, but that's a good thing. But no,
If you're going to talk about sort of not brutal but sort of tough players, tell us about Fliss Gibbons.
Fliss is a very good player. I came in not knowing of Fliss and not having heard Fliss before. But previously, when I was just moving to the Albion, we played him in a friendly, and Fliss was playing, and we were able to. I noticed Fliss as like being a very good player, but she's very adaptable because obviously she's played previously when I've known her. She's played number nine or she's been attacking, but now she's fitted into like the left back spot. But I'd say last season, towards the end of the last season, like she was a vital part for us finishing where we finished. Defensively solid. And she's attacking-minded as well. When she was playing left-back, she was getting forward. But she's one of them players that's very, like, consistent. So not very often will she put in a bad performance. And she's not that old. Like, she's still quite young and got a long way to go in her career. But someone with so much potential.
Sure. Yeah. Now, this summer, you had the very proud privilege of representing England in the Under-20s World Cup. Tell us all about that. You must have had a ball.
Yeah, no, it was a great experience. So we're away for 5 weeks that we were away for.
Tell us about the tournament first. Where was it?
The tournament was over in France, so it's based in northern France. So in our group, we had North Korea, Brazil and Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when we got the group information, we looked at the group and we thought, you know, it's quite a hard group. We didn't have a lot of expectation after where we come in the Euros last summer, like we finished third, and we come in a third place player, so we beat Scotland to get to the World Cup. So if anything, we were going into it as underdogs, and as soon as the group come out, it was all, will we get out of the group, will we not get out of the group? And I think having the label of underdog sometimes helps you because you're going into it with no expectation. But we went into it, and North Korea was our first game, and they're the reigning champions, so we always knew it was going to be a hard game. But that game was, I'd say, one of the best games of the tournament. We won 3-1, which was a great start for us, and again, something that wasn't expected to happen. And it put us in good stead going on to the rest of the games. And obviously then, second game, we had Brazil, and we were winning 1-0. And we conceded late on, so that was quite a blow for us because we'd been on quite a high. And we then knew that we had to win the last game in order to progress through to the next stage, so the knockout stages. But we then faced Mexico, which again, I'd say it was a bit of a wobbly performance because the first half we were 1-0 down. And we knew if it stayed like that, then we were going home. So it was all or nothing for the second half. And they took us in at half time, and it was more a player team talk. And it was just literally put into the fact that if we don't win, we're going home. So it's now or nothing. And second half, I think it finished 6-1. So it was one of the best 45 minutes of football I've seen or like witnessed in an England shirt. And obviously that put us through into the quarterfinals of the World Cup.
But the point about these in these group stages, and in fact all the way through the tournament, is that you actually played a vital part in it. You played in all the games, didn't you?
Yeah, definitely. No, I played in all the games, and I wouldn't
every minute of all the games.
I played every minute of all the games apart from one. I got a yellow card in the Mexico game, and because of the rules of discipline, if I was to get another one in the next game, I'd miss the semi-final. So that was a reason for me being brought off.
What did you do for your yellow?
It was just a body, 50-50.
Oh, of course,
the refs in tournament football, especially in international football, are quite strict. So what would get given as a foul over there wouldn't necessarily be a foul in WSO1. Like, it's very different.
Okay. But, I mean, tell us about... I mean, did you have a similar role within the England setup as the one you got at the Brighton setup?
Yeah, definitely. I think we play a slight... Well, we play the same formation. At England, it was more of... There was two sitting midfielders, so I'd sit alongside someone else. And throughout the games, like, it was just... Literally out of possession, it was always the same. Like, we'd sit in front of the back four, and I think that's very similar to how we play here, or can be, depending on who we're playing. Like, it'll often be me alongside Danny or someone else alongside Danny. Like, it was very similar to how we play here, so, which I think that helped me, but no. Yeah, it was very similar.
Okay, so you got through to the quarters. Tell us about that game.
So in the quarterfinals, we played Holland. Mm-hmm. Previously, I think we played Holland last year in the Euros, and we lost 2-0. So going into the game, again, it was no expectation, although we went into it thinking we could win this time, like, because we've got a new group, well, not a new group of players, but we'd come a long way in over the year. And we went in thinking that we were able to get the win. But we wanted revenge more than anything, because last year, not necessarily revenge, but for us to prove ourselves, like, what we can do. So we went into a game, like, exactly knowing that we had to win to get through. A very good first half, very even, although we did concede early on, so we were losing 1-0. We came out second half, scored straight away, and then we got another one. But it was all about then not sitting off or not just holding on to the lead. We just wanted to go and do more. But it was a good game for us, and we came out 2-1. And that made history, if anything else, because there's never been a group that under-20s women group to do that. So we knew we'd done that. So, yeah, we won 2-1, and then we got through to the semis.
Semi-finals. Now, Japan's got a long history of very good women's football. So you always knew that was going to be tough, didn't you?
Yeah, no, definitely. We'd played Japan previously in a friendly at St George's Park, I'd say 2 months beforehand, and very different style of play, very similar to North Korea, but all very small, very agile, very technical, so we knew what we were coming up against. And the game itself, like, fair play to them, like, sometimes it's just better team on the day. And on that day it was, like, we conceded 2. First half for us wasn't great. We conceded 2, losing 2-0. And we came out second half, and I think more so we went for it, because in the first half we sat off them. And they come on to us, and obviously they scored 2 goals, which could have been prevented, but it's one of those games. And then second half we went for it more, and we had chances. But I think personally the better team won on the day, and then obviously they went on to win it, so they were the champions. But no.
What did you get from this personally, from the whole tournament? How did you sort of come away from it?
I think I came away on a high, if anything. I think it'd been such a great experience, and from when I was young to go and play for a World Cup, it's always been someone's dream. And to go out there, and I was never expected to play, like, I never expected myself to play as much as I did. So to go out there and get that experience to be able to come back here and put that into practice, it was just... I think it's one experience that I will never forget. And to this day, I'd say it was the best experience of my life so far.
So if you did well at the under-20s, does that mean that you're going to be in the under-21s next year?
This year it moves on to the under-23, so it's a next-gen squad, okay. Which moves on, which is like Shadows, the senior squad. So now it's a waiting game for when the next camp is and seeing if you get selected. But it's more into senior football now. I'd say that was my last...
Sure. As a junior?
Group. Yeah, as a junior, okay. International, yeah.
So Chloe Peplow, professional footballer. Sounds good. Now, you're about to launch into the first season in the WSL. How are you feeling about that?
Excited, I'd say, more than anything. I think we've got a very good squad. Hope brought in some good players, so we've got a lot of depth in the squad. And again, as being one of the new clubs coming into it, I don't think there's a lot of expectation on our shoulders. So it'd be nice for us to go into the season and going into it as underdogs, but maybe proving people wrong and seeing what we can get out of the season. But no, I think we've had a very good pre-season. Well, for what I've heard of it, I wasn't here for much of it. But coming back,
playing for England, weren't you?
No, but coming back, I think the girls have had a good pre-season. We've had a good run of fixtures that have helped on friendlies and a couple of good results. Obviously, against Tottenham, it's a disappointment. But Chelsea, I was a good performance put in. Like, I was keeping track of the game when I was away. So there's lots of positives like going into the new season. We're all very excited.
Now, we spoke to Hope earlier and she said that the goal for the season is to avoid relegation. I think she's under no illusions that it's actually going to be very tough. It's a big step up and that all you girls are on a big learning curve. So if that's what she wants as a manager, do you have any personal goals for the season?
Personal goals for the season is I'd just like to bring my form from international back into my club football and be able to replicate that on the pitch and obviously try and get as many minutes as I can for Brighton this season on the pitch and help them to do our goal so that is not getting relegated, like do all I can to help that. But I think it will be an exciting season for us and we're all just so excited to get going.
That was Chloe Peplow talking earlier this week. And before that, you heard from Hope Powell with additional questions from Juliet Parkin from BBC South East. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com on DAB and on our podcast on Audio Boom. And this show is sponsored by oldfootballshirts.com. And we forever thank Phil Shelley for his continued support. Now, each week on the show, he selects a shirt from his huge library of 90. I think we're up to about 93,000 shirts. And tells a little story about it. So, Marcus, you can see that shirt in front of you. Could you describe that for our listener?
Yeah. Okay. It's predominantly three colours. It's kind of Hull City orange, Netherlands orange, and black. If you can imagine, the shoulders are kind of the top half of the shoulders are sort of Netherlands orange. Mm-hmm. The bottom half of the shoulders are Hull City orange. So
you've got
sort of darker or amber.
Amber.
But it's just trying to paint a picture. And then you've got the front and presumably what is the back of the shirt as well, which can only be described as sort of amber predominantly as the base, and then pinstripes, which would be black pinstripes, and the sort of Holland orange.
It's a really bad boating blazer.
It's reminiscent of the type of pinstripes I'm sort of talking about, the ones of the old Santex shirt that we used to wear at a Goldstone in the mid 90s. It's they're thin sort of pinstripes
any idea who the team might be?
Well, bearing in mind there's a Lotteria sponsor, I'm going to sound like 80 now, and another sponsor with two sponsors on the front and the kit maker and badges on the sleeves and everything. I'm going for somewhere Central American.
Okay,
I guess. But
so Uncle Phil has written for us this week. This is the 2016 away shirt for Argentinian side.
Oh right,
Chaco Forever. Their hometown is Residencia in the province of Chaco in northern Argentina, and they are nicknamed El Negro. They currently play in Zone B of the regionalised third level of Argentine football, Torneo Argentino A. Phil, the things know, mate.
Wow.
The team is named after El Chaco Jimenez, and the stadium is called the Estadio Juan Alberto Garcia, with an impressive capacity of 23,000. Their current goalkeeper is Gaston Canuto. There must be a joke somewhere there about holding back the tide of goals. Let all men know how empty and worthless is the power of kings, for there is none worthy of the name, but he whom heaven, earth, and sea obey by eternal law, said King Canuto in 1027, apparently. In all honesty, says Uncle Phil, I can't find anything interesting about the team or their players, but I did like the name. And actually, I wouldn't mind betting, Marcus, you didn't mind the kit either.
No, it's not too bad. It's a bit sort of, when you look at it. But actually, when it settles down and your senses adjust to it, it's all right. It's all right, yeah.
Now, one of the things that's happened since the Albion have got promoted to the Premier League last year is that we've noticed, certainly here on the Albion Raw, is that we're attracting a lot of new fans from around the world. The Premier League is clearly a global brand, and you know we've now got to realise just how global it is, just how popular it is. Now, obviously, the likes of Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United, and so on, they've been at this for years, and you know they are massive international stuff. But even when people have come back to us, the Albion Raw, to say, you know, can I have a fan's perspective? And it's someone who's out in Australia or someone who's American. So with that in mind, and we are getting messages on social media about this, we thought, well, let's have a natter randomly with one of them. So I'm delighted to say that I'm now talking on the line to Laura Ellen Ashcraft, who is a brand new Brighton fan, speaking to me from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Laura Ellen, how are you?
I am doing so well. I'm really honoured and really excited to be on the Albion War and to be a brand new fan of Brighton.
Okay, so before we start talking about your new love of all things Albion, tell us a wee bit about yourself first.
Yeah, so I am originally born and bred in Pennsylvania, here in the northeastern United States. I was born about an hour or so outside of Philadelphia, and then I moved to the other side of the state, to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and so that's where I've lived for the past 6 years or so. I am currently a second-year PhD student in the School of Social Work here at the University of Pittsburgh, and so that's a really exciting thing, and I'm interested in policy and healthcare access for rural populations, which is something we deal a lot with here in Pennsylvania and here in the United States. So that's what I do during the day, but I mostly just, you know, pretend to be skiing, but sit on Twitter and read about soccer, whether it's my team or, you know, whatever team it is.
Now, of all teams you could have picked, I mean, how long have you been into football?
Yeah, so I went to Argentina twice in high school. And so that's how I was really exposed to international soccer. And so it was right around the time when Messi was really beginning to play for Barcelona's first team. And so I immediately became a Barcelona fan, which, you know, seems very stereotypical, but was a fan from the perspective that I loved Argentina, loved watching Messi play, you know, and then grew to love Iniesta, you know, and all the greats that have recently come out of Barcelona. And then, you know, and I've always kind of been a Premier League snob in the sense that I just didn't like English football, which I know sounds really terrible, especially where I know it's really bad. You know, and my husband has been a Spurs fan for as long as I can remember.
This gets worse.
Which I know. Well, just hold on. It'll get better. So, you know, he had always said, you know, you should really give it a try. I really do think you would like it. But a couple months ago, one of my professors here at school, who has also been a Premier League fan for the longest time, you know, and we've had many conversations about how awful it was that I didn't follow English soccer. And he said to me, you know, you should pick a team that has recently come into the Premier League within the past 3 years. I will also pick a team. And whichever of our two teams finishes higher at the end of the season, the other person would take that person out for lunch. And so I, you know, I'm a researcher. That's what I do. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, not too much time, but a fair amount of time researching teams. And so, you know, I had looked at, you know, a couple different teams. You know, my husband had, you know, made a couple suggestions, which of course I ignored, as any good wife does. And I had finally chosen Brighton as my team, not really thinking too much about it. I liked the colors. I liked the fact, you know, it sounds very superficial. This makes me sound very shallow.
Yes.
But then as soon as I picked my team, and then I said to myself, okay, well, I picked this team. I need to learn everything that there is to know about them.
I have to interrupt at this point. At what point are we talking about here? How long ago was this that you picked the Albion?
Like a month and a half ago.
Oh, crikey, that new. All right. Okay. Sorry. I do apologize. Carry on.
So I said, I picked this team. I need to learn about them. So I went on Twitter and I followed all the Twitter handles. So, you know, the team handles. And of course, I found the Albion Roar and, you know, began listening and subscribing. And then I found Brighten Up. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to read this. So I ordered it. It took a very long time to get to the U.S. And so I'm kind of halfway through it at this point. But it's been very interesting to learn about the team, learn about the history, you know, with moving stadiums and, you know, the tragedy that you've experienced as a community and how you've come together. And so the more I learn about the team and the community and the club as a whole, the more excited I am to support this team. Oh, absolutely. And I think for me, one of the things that this sounds a little silly, but, you know, certainly, you know, beating Manchester United a couple weeks ago was, you know, certainly a highlight to watch. And I sat on my couch and screamed and scared my dogs and I'm sure my neighbors during that game. But I think for me, it's not just about what happens on the field. It's also about what happens off of the field. And so, you know, I think seeing the club providing feminine products for all its fans, to me,
yeah, you've seen that. You've seen that campaign, have you?
Yes. Yeah, I have. And I think, you know, for me, it's not just about kind of like, oh, look at this thing that we're, you know, it's not necessarily just about the feminine products. Well, I think that's an important component. It's about, we want to create a community and a space that all people are able to feel comfortable in our space, in our stadium, in our club. And to me, that, you know, kind of speaks volumes. You know, certainly I want to see high quality play on the field, but to have the community involvement, I think is such an important component to me. And one of the questions I have for you would be, what are some of the, yes, I know, I have a list here.
Oh, no.
But what are some of the other things that the club has done to really engage the community and to promote a community atmosphere?
Well, I think one of the things that you get to realise if you start reading, and I think that Nick Schepanek mentions it in Brighten Up, is just how vast the Albion the community scheme is. And it started about 25 years ago. And the Albion has really embraced it, well, it has done ever since the year dot, but massively so, and probably just about the biggest way you can do, is that there is a huge, I suppose, mural outside the club shop on the stadium wall as you approach it from the railway station, the nearby railway station. And it has eight people on the front of it, and it's two are representing the men's team, two are representing the women's team. But then you'll have, there's a representative of the power chair team, someone from the amputee team, someone from the deaf team, and someone from the cerebral palsy team. It also has a walking team. It also has a variety of teams catering for so many social issues and physical disabilities across the county, and in each discipline. And this is something that the club is so proud of, or rather I'm proud of on behalf of the club, is that in every single discipline, and we're talking about the men's football, the women's football, the juniors, and all the various disabilities, is that they're all in the top division of their particular pursuit. So one thing that's not going to happen this year is we're not going to have a promotion parade, because we're already in every single aspect of the club in the top division, and no club in the country, and I might even argue if there are equivalent things across Europe, I can probably happily say no other club in Europe actually has that level of commitment across the club, across all their teams, and that's something to be immensely proud of.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and it certainly sounds to me, and again, everything that I've been reading and watching and listening to really indicates to me that this club is a leader in these areas. And I think for me, you know, I think back about my decision again, you know, a month and a half, 2 months ago, which is, you know, a very short amount of time. But I just couldn't have picked a better team for the things that I value and the things
again.
That I believe in. I know. I'm trying to flatter you because you've
really?
Been so kind to me. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, fair enough. So, I mean, you say you're in Pittsburgh. Now, we know that there are now Brighton fans across the United States, some of whom are American people, some of whom are expats. So have you connected with anyone across the States, either on social media or even, you know, sort of face-to-face when it comes to, well, English football, but more specifically about the Albion?
So in regards to English football, yes. So like,
well, apart
said,
from your husband, that doesn't count.
Well, I was going to say, yes. So my husband's a Spurs fan, but then I have friends who, I actually have a good friend of mine who's a Fulham fan. So we had some discussion back and forth this past weekend. But you know, the normal, candidates. So, you know, Manchester United, City, there's a new, mini series or something about Manchester City on Netflix or something. So people are watching that and deciding that they should be City fans, at least I only read Wikipedia or something. No, and then there are the Chelsea fans, which, you know, just, you know, and I have a couple of friends, Arsenal fans. So, you know, there is the smattering of the major clubs. And then you see a few people here and there who pick clubs, you know, outside of that. You know, like I said, I have a good friend who's a Fulham fan, but other than that, I mean, it's predominantly the major clubs that you, at least internationally, that you think of.
In that case, I know you've only been a Brighton fan in that case for 6 weeks, but I'm going to embarrass you now, I'm going to make it incumbent upon you, either across the city of Pittsburgh or across the America generally, to be the cheerleader. The Albion Royals official cheerleader across the States, to encourage people to start following the Albion, you know, jettison the big sort of overly successful clubs. One thing that we actually get to realise that as Brighton fans, is that because we've had all the negative things that have happened in the past 20 years and the protests and the campaigns and all the things like that, is that we get to appreciate victories. And, you know, like playing Manchester United and beating them twice this year, like beating Arsenal, those victories are all the sweeter because we've actually had all the lows. Whereas if you're a City fan or a Chelsea fan or a United fan, victory is expected, and therefore, you know, it's not going to be quite so sweet. It's not going to be quite such a great thing. So there is an element of, you know, we're not exactly a hard luck story, but now that we're in the big time, we still are not one of the big sides. So if you can actually sort of, you know, place it upon yourself to actually encourage people, saying, look, forget the big sides, come and support this lot, because this lot are something else, would you do that for us?
Absolutely. I will happily do that.
Right. So now that you've actually promised to be the cheerleader for the Albion in Pittsburgh, is there going to be a point in the near future, do you think, you're going to come over to watch the Albion at the Amex Stadium?
You know, I'm really going to try. I did look at my schedule, and I looked at flights, my school schedule, of course, and I looked at flights. And I'm not sure that it's going to happen this season, just because of how my coursework kind of lands with things. You know, I'll have to do some more calculations and see if I can squeeze it in potentially over the holidays. But I'm definitely looking at next year and next season because, you know, I'm done with coursework after this year. And so next year I will have a bit more free time when I'm working on my dissertation to then come over and perhaps do some visiting because I want to make, you know, a full experience of it. I want to see your city, see your region, see your country while also, you know, getting to see a couple games. I think that would be really exciting.
I think so too. I'd hope you enjoy it. I mean, having read up on the things that you're doing and the things that you're studying for, then I think you'd appreciate the city of Brighton Hove. I mean, it's quite a bizarre city, you know, where the unusual is the norm here, and we just do things kind of upside down, back to front, and get on with it accordingly. I mean, do you think you could throw yourself into that quite easily?
Oh, I think so. I think I could manage.
Brilliant. Listen, Laura Ellen, thank you so much for being on the Albion Raw. It's been great to talk to you. And you'll keep in touch with us and on social media and on the show and just let us know how you're getting on with recruiting people in Pittsburgh. Would you do that?
Absolutely. And thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Okay. That was Laura Ellen Ashcraft, a brand new Albion fan in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Marcus, he's still here. He's decided to stick around rather than go to the pub. when the Amex opened, I mean, you know, we all thought, you know, we're going from an 8,000 ground to a 22,000 ground. You think, oh no, there's going to be a bunch of JCLs, but they've really enriched the club, haven't they?
The East stand up at no. I have, and you know, Tony Bloom knows that, and they started early doors with the giving out when we even was with Dean giving out the sort of free kits and the birthday cards for the kids and signing up for all the goodie bags and everything because we lost a whole generation of fans when we moved to Gillingham.
Do you think we've got them back
in the wilderness? Yes. I certainly do think so. There's certainly a lot of stories where suddenly people, which you know, slap on the wrist, finger wag for them when they then decided to bugger off and support Chelsea, and then when the Albion have come back to it, you know, don't get me started. but we need them because we're not going to, you know, you don't survive without the fan base because we're not. Someone like Man United could survive without any fans visiting Old Trafford, such as the money that they get from Champions League sponsorships, everything like that. They could play in an empty stadium week after week, and they don't need the fans to fill the stadium, but we do because we're trying to establish ourselves a Premier League club. We could still go down, hopefully we won't. So we're going to need those fans if we go down, I'm all for it.
And I think it's all getting better. Listen, you've been listening to the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM. Thanks very much to Marcus Hancock for coming in at the last minute. Thank you to and thanks to our other guests, to Hope Powell, Chloe Peplow, and Laura Ellen Ashcraft. My name's Alan Wares, and we'll be back next week with more of the same. Cheers for now.